Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Jonathan Last, sitting in for Charlie Sykes. I'm joined today by my colleague at the Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, and my new best friend, Tim Miller. Tim, hey, how are you?
JVL, how have we not met before today? What are the chances of that?
Because I'm a recluse.
You don't
and go, I don't meet people, ever.
You didn't go to any of the Neocon happy hours? Or
you know, this is my favorite part of the, you people don't get on board with Trump because you want to go to all of these mainstream media cocktail party stuff, is that you could not pay me enough money to go to a party of any sort, but especially a cocktail party with
any, with like, journalists?
Anybody.
I literally moved to Oakland to stop going to cocktail parties with journalists, so I had a good excuse.
It's the worst. But we get to meet each other through the magic of podcast. It's very nice to have
it's
you
lovely.
Here. And thank you for writing for us. Tim, you wrote a great piece for us last week about... it was an open letter to people, generals, business tycoons, governors, anybody who might be thinking of running for president as a Republican in 2020. How real do you think the chances of a primary challenge are? I have my own thoughts on this, but I, you know, like to hear what smarter people think.
I think it's greater than conventional wisdom that there'll be a primary challenge. One of the reasons that I wrote the article is I think that, you know, there have been, Charlie's written about this, other people, with bigger platforms than me have written about sort of the moral case against Trump and the philosophical case against Trump. But I think the practical case for a primary is far greater than, you know, what the conventional wisdom is. And so that was the argument that I wanted to make in the article, that, you know, for a sitting congressman, even for a governor, for somebody outside the political sphere, there are massive upsides to running against Trump. I mean, besides... being able to make the right and moral and conservative case for, you know, how the party should look, you have a huge platform, a global platform. I mean, anybody that primaries Trump immediately becomes what, one of the 100 most famous people in the world, you know, because you're on every news program. Trump's tweeting mean things about you. People are obsessed about talking about Donald Trump, like people that like him, people that hate him. And so, you know, you have this huge opportunity as somebody who, you know, cares about politics, who's in the political sphere to make your mark. As I wrote in the article, primary campaigns are, you know, sort of where a lot of, you know, ideas sprout from parties. We've seen that in the past. So you have an opportunity to shape that. And it's Donald Trump. Truly anything can happen. And if you can look at this primary and see Donald Trump and not think, you know, something outlandish could happen that either causes him to nosedive in popularity very late in the campaign, where you're kind of the only one standing there with the bag. I just think that there are a lot of really smart and practical reasons to make the case. And so for that reason, I think that there's got to be somebody else out there who sees that opportunity and decides to take advantage of it and enter the primary.
Sarah, are you basically where Tim and I are on the likelihood, chances, prospects for a primary?
Yeah, I'm extremely bullish about there being a primary, and there's a lot of people talking about it. I was excited to see Hogan last week come out and signal that maybe he was thinking about it, you know, talking about his father being one of the first people to impeach Nixon, having Jeb introduce him. He didn't have to do those things. And so that felt like a little bit of a toe in the water. But I wanted to ask Tim, one of the things that struck me about your piece that I think is really important is, you know, when you're talking about the character of the kind of person that runs, one of the things you mentioned is it has to come from the gut. It has to be this thing that somebody's really driven to do. It can't be that donors, you know, come and say, hey, you know, we want to draft you to do this. It has to be something that you really, really want to do something like run against Donald Trump. So talk a little bit about what the character of the person is that could really actually take on Donald Trump and win potentially.
This is actually one of the great, I think another reason to get into this race and, you know, one of the great opportunities for this, for a candidate to enter is that because the conventional wisdom and the expectations are so low, you know, you're not beholden to, you know, make a lot of the kind of petty political compromises that people have to make in campaigns. And as somebody who's been involved in three Republican primaries now, presidential Republican primaries, I do feel like sometimes in these bigger fields, you see people getting in and they have to, you know, run a campaign based on what they think the 1 foot in front of them, the most, you know, what the political necessities require. And it doesn't, the campaign doesn't ever, you know, leave a mark. They lose the race and, you know, they found themselves not really kind of running on the things that make them uniquely qualified. That wouldn't be the case here, right? You're getting in, it's a total long shot, and you know a big reason for why you're getting in this race is because you want to leave a mark for, and, you know, I don't want to overstate it and be obnoxious, but really it is. It's kind of like you're leaving a historical mark. People are going to talk about this race, for better or worse, in history books, you know, on political panels for the next, you know, half century. And so before you get in, you have to have the mindset of what kind of race am I going to run that, you know, allows me to leave that mark? And you have to get in knowing that you're going to be losing in the polls pretty much every day that you're in the race up until you get right up to those primaries. And, you know, hopefully, you know, something strikes, you know, and you have sort of the reverse Buchanan effect, right? And so, you know, if you're getting in because, you know, you want to have like positive political process stories happen about you, like that's not the reason to run this race. The reason is because you absolutely believe that, you know, you are uniquely positioned, your life story, your experience to make a case contra Donald Trump. And you know, that is a huge opportunity for entering the race. And I think that, you know, it takes away a lot of those, you know, what the sort of, you know, political beat writers want to talk about, which is, you know, the polls and the donors and the stuff that kind of takes over primaries sometimes. You know, nobody thinks you're going to win, so you don't have to worry about that.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is that one of the upsides about whoever jumps into challenge, and again, I have always thought it is like a 55-45% chance we get a challenger, maybe 60-40. Yeah, not a sure thing, but not by any means a long shot. I think better than even odds. You instantly go to 20% in the polls. You know, traditionally when you make a primary run, the hardest thing in the world is to register first. You don't think so? Yeah, I mean, looking at the numbers in
anybody?
Iowa.
Yeah, it depends on who you are. I mean,
not to throw shade, but like, you know, like if some pothead type, I don't want to say names, but really, you know, like if Gary Johnson were to run, Gary Johnson doesn't go to 20% in the polls. But if Larry,
I don't know. It seems like the primary electorate's a little bit more anti-Syria intervention than we thought. Maybe he would have some support.
But no, I mean, I think if Larry Hogan were to announce tomorrow, I think a week later he's at 20% in New Hampshire. Because there is some tiny piece, I think pretty sizable piece, just if you go by the polling data, of the Republican electorate who really is not on board. They'll vote for Trump against the commie if they have to, but in a primary situation is going to be very happy to. I mean, this is the polling data you cited, something like, you know, in Iowa, I think it is, it's, you know, 60% of Republican voters are open to and welcome a primary challenge. Nationally, it's something like 42% welcome a primary challenge. Those are not the signs of a party which is really thrilled to be with the guy they have.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's true, that somebody would immediately go to 20%, and I think that that's okay. I think that right now there is this, you know, tribal, you know, kind of deep-seated desire to defend Donald Trump from Republican regulars. And I'm not talking about the red hat crowd. I'm talking about just your average, you know, Republican primary voter from what they feel is unfair, overblown, obnoxious attacks on him from the media, from the left. And in some cases, I think rightly, you know, the media, you know, I think underblows some stories about Trump, but has obviously made mistakes, has overblown it. And so I think that there is going to be a little bit while 63% of people are open to a primary and are happy to see a primary, you know, race, which is encouraging to me because, you know, I do think some of the conventional wisdom in D.C. is like these people don't even want a race. Like they just want to coronate him again. It's a personality cult. That's a minority of the party that feel that way. So I think that people want a race and they'll want to see, you know, the what kind of campaign this person runs. You know, I don't think a, you know, MSNBC, you know, just anti Trump all the time, jumping on every anti Trump thing. I think that these voters are defensive enough of Trump that they might not jump to 20% right away. But I think that they're going to be open to it. And you know, as Trump makes this person's job easy, I think that getting up to 20%, you know, is certainly reasonable and higher.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's clear is people that they're not going to want to be scolded by whoever gets in, right? They don't want to. This is something that we see a lot, you know, when his approval ratings are very high, because approval ratings are really about defending your vote from 2016 and justifying that. And then what's interesting about these sort of openness questions is that they're prospective, right? And so when you start asking people, do you want another 4 years of this chaos? Do you want another 4 years of Trump? That's where they start to say, no, I'm open to an alternative. But if that alternative gets in and says, hey, you're all suckers and you voted for this guy and you're stupid and, you know, it just really makes people feel bad about it. They're not there for that. That person's not going to get 20%. But if you get a happy warrior who's there because they want to present an alternative vision for the Republican Party and can say, hey, look, I'm here for the judges and for the low taxes and I'm going to take terrorism seriously and I'm going to take immigration seriously. Like, I think they might be there for that, you know, but it's got to be a good future of the Republican Party vision, not sort of a looking backward.
It's negative. It's negative partisanship all the way down these days, you know. So there is going to be that initial, I think, desire to want to defend their guy. So that's why I don't know that there should be an expectation that the polls would pop right away.
So, Tim, you mentioned your time in presidential primary politics. This is I am endlessly fascinated by stories about how people run off and join the circus with this sort of stuff. Where did you start? Were you a McCain guy at first? Was he the second campaign?
No, my very first campaign was for a guy named Bill Owens, who was the governor of Colorado. Do you remember Bill?
Barely.
Jonathan. Barely. He was on the cover of National Review. The next great conservative hope.
Wow. Did it have something? Yeah. Michelle Bachmann was too.
Yeah, never took off. No. So I was.
So what was this? Is 90...
He ran first in 98 and then in 02. Okay. And so in 98, I was in high school and I had the, you know, privilege of not having to, you know, kind of work at McDonald's, right? I wanted, you know, my parents wanted me to work.
That's
but,
what
but,
I did.
You worked at McDonald's,
yeah,
literally?
I literally worked at McDonald's.
That probably would have been a good experience for me, frankly. But like my parents wanted me to do something that I cared about. And our neighbor was a donor for this guy who's running in a Republican primary for governor, Bill Owens, 98. And so I volunteered. I just went in, did whatever they needed day to day. And these governor primaries at the start are so small, you know, I would drive Owens around and be with him. You know, often. And so we built a relationship. He won against a woman named Gail Shetler, who was the lieutenant governor at the time, by, we'll have to go find it after the podcast, literally like 3,000 votes.
It went to
like 3 a.m. And as a dorky, you know, high school Republican, you know, 17-year-old in pleated pants, like I was, this was the
Must
cool,
the most exciting.
It was the most exciting night of my life, absolutely. And so he ended up. They declared it very, very late and at night, and you know, I stayed there, and it was awesome. So I caught the bug, really quickly, and then he ended up running the RGA. And so I kind of, you know, was a little political gypsy for a little while and popped around, did races in Delaware and Virginia and Iowa. And in Iowa is where I caught up with McCain in that in the 2007 primary or 2008 primary.
Right.
It was 2007.
So you did McCain World and then Jeb next?
No.
W?
Do we have to talk about it? John Huntsman.
Sarah, you should rescue me here since you guys actually are longtime buddies.
John Huntsman is
John
what
Huntsman.
I did next.
He doesn't want to talk about this because there was that incident where they spelled John Huntsman's name wrong.
That was not my fault. There were plenty of things that were my fault. That was
one job.
That was not my fault. I was dubbed Rain Cloud on that campaign. In retrospect, I say to the Huntsmans and other people involved in the campaign, I was actually Reality Cloud because I was giving the facts. They thought I was being negative. And so, I obviously have, you know, in retrospect, not loved his post presidential campaign choices to go work for Trump. But I worked on that primary. I was a national spokesperson and then begged literally like, I did a full apology tour, Obama-style apology tour with all the Romney people and just begged them to let me work for them. And there were still a couple of Romney people that were just bitter about some of my mean tweets about them or, you know, mean comments on cable. And so I couldn't get on the campaign, but they put me at the RNC where I basically served as Romney's attack dog at the RNC attacking Obama every day. And my boss there was...
Sean Spicer,
and Reince Priebus. What a turn of events!
A wicked life. What a turn you had to work for Sean Spicer.
You never would have told. You know, I never would have believed that, like, whatever it was, 5 years later, that I would, you know, go to the holidays and like my aunts and uncles would be like, you know, Sean Spicer. Like, you turned into a celebrity.
Good Lord.
It was just crazy.
Wait, just so for
but yeah, and then
keeping,
Jeb.
For people keeping score at home, yeah. Then the
O
race
for three on the primary.
Yeah, so Owens is the only race that you've ever won.
That is not actually. Well, it kind of depends on how you work. In 14, I consulted for Haley and Walker. So I'm counting those. I don't know. I don't know if the Walker or Haley people do, but I'm counting them. I started America. So after we'll just do it really fast. After Romney, I started America Rising, which it still is the biggest kind of Republican oppo shop. While I was there, you know, we did the 14th cycle, and then I consulted on a couple of governor's races. So do I count them? I count them.
You count them. That's good.
And debate
then
prep.
Went to Jeb World.
There. What? And then went to Jeb World. And this is going back to your question. I guess it was Sarah's question about the person having to get in and know in their gut that they want to run. I went and interviewed with a number of the candidates in 2015, and not Donald Trump. I won't give it away who they all were, but none of them even came close. So it was not Cruz or Rubio. So I had no chance, no matter who I picked. But I went to meet with Jeb, and it was so intimidating because while some of the other candidates I met with just, you know, seemed like they were doing it because it felt like it was time or the right thing to do or politically expedient, like, Jeb knew in his gut exactly what he wanted to do, exactly why he wanted to be president, what he would have done there. And I feel like he ran the campaign that way. And obviously it didn't work out. But, you know, these losing presidential campaigns are brutal. And so I don't want to discourage anybody listening that's thinking about running. But, you know, every day having to wake up and just, you know, get an onslaught of negative process covers because that's all the political reporters want to talk about. It is tough and it's grueling. And for Jeb, you know, especially given his pedigree, that, you know, to have to go out every day and see people and talk to people while, you know, he knows that they're watching news about whatever, how terrible and low energy he is. I couldn't have been more proud and impressed with him and how he kind of weathered that and handled that. And he handled the loss so well. And I thought that his, you know, kind of remarks, his concession remarks and everything that he said since has been so consistent with how he ran.
Just looking at Jeb, you know, when you think about the way that, you know, he was such a front runner, he was the heir apparent, and then it didn't work out. And you watched people sort of not react positively toward them. How does that make you think about the Hogan, Kasich sort of types who could get in against Trump and what the appetite might be for them? Does it dissuade you?
No. I mean, it collapsed in a week. Our best day was we had an awesome announcement. Nobody remembers it, but there were like 5,000 people there, and it was a diverse audience. I've never seen so many Hispanics at a speech, and the media coverage was great. Jeb gave, you know, a great speech, and it was just Donald Trump announced the next day. And like literally, we were in the top of the polls for 2 weeks. It goes away in a flash. And I think there is a lesson for that about Trump, right? Like there's this kind of Fifth Avenue mystique about Trump, but you know, things, you know, people are fickle. Like, things do change. Trump has a bigger base of support that he's working for than Jeb did, but it's not a majority support. And the political winds can shift. And so, I mean, that my lesson from anybody who's thinking about running, who looks at it from Jeb is twofold. One, nobody knows what the heck they're talking about. I went to the Harvard after every election, like, brings in all the consultants and has an analysis of what happened. And I went to that after the Trump election, and I'm like, you guys are all full of it. Like, none of you guys knew anything. Like, everybody was wrong every step of the way. So nobody knows, like, how, you know, Trump will wear over another primary. So I think that there is an unknown, you know, positive there. Obviously we did not know with Jeb how quickly it'd go away. The other lesson, though, is that I think that Jeb was so conservative. Because of immigration, because of Common Core, he kind of got caught up in this. The perception of him was misaligned from the reality. And so I do think a lesson for anybody getting in is that, you know, the Jeb and Kasich, you know, voter, you know, is about 15% of the party. Right. And so you do have to be, you know, very mindful if you're going to get into this race and you want to run a serious challenge against Trump. That, you know, you have to get outside of that, and that you get defined really quick. And Jeb got kind of defined into that Kasich, Jeb, you know, sort of limited audience as much faster. You know, like, literally he was defined that way as soon as he got in the race, basically, besides that first speech, you know, immediately. And it was hard for him to break out of it.
You did power rankings for these Republicans, JVL, recently. I actually thought you were a little bit ungenerous to John Kasich. Why was that?
Because
he's out there doing the work, at least. I mean, he's out there saying the things that we want Republicans to be saying, isn't he?
Yes, I think he is. I do not think he is the perfect messenger. Because he is a little bit more moderate probably than when he should be. I mean, I think really the way to challenge Trump is actually from his right. Right. I mean, I'm sorry, you guys wanted a wall. Well, where's your wall? You had unified control of the government, right?
Ann Coulter is going to be an excellent candidate.
I was going to ask you, did you see Ann Coulter this weekend? When she said we wanted Trump. We voted for Trump,
but we got Jeb. Thanks, Ann.
No, but it was great. You know what? Actually, I really appreciated it because Ann has been given a crap sandwich here, and she's decided she's not going to eat it and say that it's steak.
She did write a book called In Trump We Trust.
She did. No, and it was, believe me, it's wrong. But this is, you know, like the Big Lebowski, like, say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, but at least it's an ideology.
At least it's an ethos.
At least it's an ethos. And Anne has that. Like, you know, she doesn't like brown people, and she wants them out of here.
That's an ethos.
But she really believes it, and she is not going to just eat whatever Trump serves to her at this point.
Yeah. I'm gonna caveat what I'm going to say next, which is really a bad thing to say on a podcast that people want interesting things. But I have a personal policy that I instituted, which is if you're a conservative, if you're a Republican and you're anti-Trump, I'm not going to say anything mean about you. Because I think it's crazy. We are a tiny, we're 15% of the party. I just talked about it of 40% of the country, and never Trumpers like to dissect like as narrowly as possible more than anybody I've ever met. I mean, there are so many articles about which strand of never Trump you are.
But he's not for predestination, and we believe in free will. It is like the crazy information splintering.
Yeah, yes. and it's just not, and it's not helpful. And really, in on balance, like the differences aren't that great. Like Sarah, the differences are style over substance.
I was not mean to Kasich. I think I was ranking five
Kasich,
people.
You gave him a meh. That was your ranking.
I wrote more than that. I ranked five guys. I put him in the middle, and I put him below.
Who did you put last?
Who did I put last?
Well, you had Haley. You had Mattis.
You have to understand, my rankings were done a holistic way in which I was combining both the chances of them running with the seriousness of the threat they posed,
right,
should they run. Right. No. So it isn't actually science.
Sure.
It was really just, you know, these, like the sports book touts say,
yeah,
you know, for entertainment purposes only. Don't take this to the sports book and try to win money with it. This is I'll do more of that with the Democrats who are actually running, because I think you can, you know, once you understand what people are doing. You know, the Jeb thing is one of those accidents of history where in his first gubernatorial race, he lost by 34,000 votes, I think. Right. And the whole history of the United States is different if 17,000 Florida voters swing the other way, because he's the sitting governor first.
Yeah.
He probably runs for president and not W. He's president during nine.
And, well, everything in some ways he might have. And I, and you know, I love Jeb. So he's by far the favorite, my favorite person I've ever worked for. But in some ways he might have not been as good of a contrast with Gore, though. Honestly, Gore might have ended up being president, right? From a personality standpoint, you know, I think W. You know, obviously, you know, his sort of Texas swagger was a big part of his appeal. You talked about the first 17,000 voters, Florida voters, maybe the next time around. I guess Jeb probably would have won Florida because he was extremely popular there at the time, but might have maybe lost Pennsylvania or somewhere else, right? So who the heck knows? But, I mean, back to the original point, I think that the primary challenger, without being mean to anybody that is anti-Trump that's considering running, needs to, as you were saying, run from a, you know, from a strong, you know, conservative base, not just economically but culturally, you know, not playing with the Trump racist garbage, but you know, talking to cultural conservatives, blue collar, you know, voters, you know, not being too wonkish or bookish about it, and that is, you know, I'll support anybody that runs against him, but I think that of the field, you know, the people that seem the strongest are the ones that are going to be able to expand that appeal out to, you know, people that voted for Cruz and, you know, things of that nature.
Yeah, I just wonder about whether or not, you know, at this point, Trump is such a chaos candidate. Could it be possible that
who coined that?
Was that you?
No, not me.
Chaos candidate?
No, it was Jeb. It was not me.
Well, the quality of the person could simply be, you know, a pendulum swing back to somebody stable. You know, I think somebody like, I'm not getting in the tank for one person or another, but you take somebody like Governor Hogan, and that is a very sort of stable, you know, moderate person who is personally conservative culturally. I think he does speak to blue collar people. He hasn't been in the Senate, you know, having to do kind of the Never Trump thing. He's been out in Maryland, you know, got reelected by 12% in a blue state. Could just his sort of being a solid guy.
About Hogan. Yeah, I agree with you to the point that when I talk about being able to speak to these sort of culturally conservative voters, it is a lot more about style than issue by issue, right? And it's more about signaling, you know, this sort of negative partisanship, right? Like signaling that I'm not running this campaign to like get popular with Morning Joe, right?
But it
like,
doesn't have to be build a wall certain policies, anti-gay, things like that.
Yeah, you got a knife AOC in your first. In your announcement speech,
in the media, and the media, and
let them all come after you to help prove
for sure. And I just think that Trump proved that like this, you know, the true con, so to speak, like that there's this, you know, that voters are demanding, you know, a candidate that is down the line conservative on every single issue. Wrong. You know, that was conventional wisdom 4 years ago by every smart person that the Republican primary, you've got to be down the line on issues. So I think that Hogan, despite, you know, being away from where the Republican base is on a couple of issues, I don't know that that matters if somebody like him is able to kind of signal to them that he's on their team against the bad guys, you know, which is the left and the media, that he or she, if they can do that, I think that where exactly they are on issues will be something that is, you know, kind of fun to debate on the Bulwark and NRO and the Federalist. But like, I don't think that that's as important.
My political slash fiction is that I want Christie to run against him. Like a Chris Christie who is, you know, all out of F's to give. And
I'm so mad at him, though.
That's the primary America deserves.
Talk about contra history, though. And look, I was no Marco fan, right? I mean, we had a tough primary between Jeb and Marco. But like how big of a, I'm not going to say the word, wuss do you have to be if you're Chris Christie? And he's just like, he's Cartman. He's like such a bully. There's nothing behind it. You know, to attack Marco, right? He never threw one punch at Donald Trump. He was on stage with him 9 times, and Chris Christie never stood up to Donald Trump a single time. And to take it to 11 against Marco, you know, who knows how things would have shaken out. Marco was polling, you know, in our internal polling very well before that New Hampshire debate where Christie took him down.
That was a sanctioned hit. I mean, if you go and look at the poll numbers actually there,
yeah.
that debate killed Romney, or killed Rico Romney, Rubio. Killed Rubio in New Hampshire, which blunted the momentum he had in
and
down
so
south.
I don't want to give Christie the credit that he could go YOLO against Trump. I don't know that he has it in him. I just think he's
sitting there waiting for a job for 2 years. He keeps getting passed over for all these other cucks, and just because Jared is right there, it'd be amazing.
Yeah, it's easy to pick on Jared, though. You know,
well, of course, right? That's what you have to do.
It's easy to punch Jared. Like, is he actually able to punch Trump? I don't think so. I'm not giving that fan fiction. I won't accept JVL. No, screw Christie.
So, Sarah, do you want to talk at all about the Democrats, Sarah, or no? I would love to like put a quarter in the Tim Miller machine and just hear what if you were going to handicap the Dem side.
Yeah, I mean. I was thinking this morning, I was like, are there only women in so far? But then I remembered the Texas Castro is in. So there's at least one dude who's thrown his hat in the ring so far. But,
Sherrod Kamala is going to.
Kamala got in today.
Garcetti is going to, we think, right?
Yeah, so Tim, if Trump does, if we are unsuccessful in our ability to primary Trump, who is the best Democrat to take him on?
No, that's a value judgment. I mean, you can answer
that
question.
I want Seth Moulton.
But what I really...
Which is the kiss of death. Tim Miller's endorsement in the Democratic primary is absolutely the kiss of death.
You can answer Sarah's question, but my question is less of a should and more of a would. Like, when you look at the Democratic field, what do you see? Because, like, you know, you do this for a living. You've been around.
I mean, look, I think that I'm going to look back really quick to look forward. And another interesting counterfactual, like, had Bernie been able to break into the African-American base in the Democratic primary.
Even a little,
he would have been the nominee and maybe the president, right? Like, we were that close to having a socialist president, you know, and I think that had Hillary run against somebody, you know, like had, like Deval Hatrick's got to be looking back at history and been
and
like,
Liz
man,
Warren too,
I would
right?
be the president, you know, like somebody that could have done anything to get black turnout for them. So as you look at the Democratic primary, you know, I think Nate Silver's done a nice job of sort of breaking it down, right? Like, the, you know, you've got
those graphs of his, I just found mystery.
Yeah.
like layer five of them. I was like, ah.
Yeah, but that's exactly how I would look at that race. I mean, you know, it's funny, even though the Democrats are going to be completely lockstep on a far left, you know, quasi-socialist, you know, sort of European agenda, there's going to be almost no policy difference, right, besides Bernie. Like, everybody else is going to be basically just kind of capitalist liberal. There might be minor little policy nits here and there, but overall, they're all going to be aligned. So the primary, and there's going to be a huge disincentive to attack each other on personal things, right? Because there's just this loathing of Trump in the Democratic base that's like anything that you do to attack a fellow Democrat might rebound back on you negatively. And so it's honestly going to be a lot of kind of cultural attachment, identity, you know, politics, like who is going to be able to best rally, you know, black voters, who's going to be able to best rally, like, kind of the younger sort of, you know, former Obama college kids that are now my age in their 30s. You know, that is going to, you know, is Beto able to do that? Is Kamala going to be able to, you know, sort of get a stranglehold on black voters or not? Liz Warren, you know, where does she, where does she fit into that? So I think that it's going to be fascinating to watch, because they're going to have to do these little subtle things to appeal to each of those constituencies without, without having, it ricochet back against them.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Sarah. No,
is there any chance that these sort of progressives fracture the progressive vote and that a moderate sort of sneaks in?
No. I don't think so. Though, again, similarly to the Republican side, the conventional wisdom in D.C. that there is like these sort of policy litmus tests is not really true, right, on the Democratic side. Somebody could, in theory, do that as long as they are like signaling that they're the anti-Trumpiest. You know, I do think that there could be an opening for somebody who whose pitch on the Democratic side is, I'm going to kick his ass the best, right? Like, you want to see me. Like, there was this member in the Republican primaries back in 12, like, when Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich popped.
Yeah.
And it was solely on Republican voter fantasies of watching Newt Gingrich debate Obama, which I don't think would have went as well as they thought. But, like, in their mind, they were just, like, frothing at seeing Newt, you know, just stick it to Obama once. And I think that will be true on this time. So in the debates, you know, there'll be a kind of a performative aspect. And so I don't know exactly who this would be. It would probably be somebody from outside of the political sphere. You know, could, I think, get into the Democratic primary, you know, without being a down the line liberal, if and only if they sold themselves as the best Trump antidote.
Is there a black swan out there waiting in the Democratic universe? Because the big lesson I took, like the most macro level from 2016, was that there were sizable portions of both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party who hated their parties. And that's what the Trump campaign was, and that's what the Sanders campaign was. And these were people who were deeply disaffected with their own parties and wanted to kind of blow it up and remake them.
Yeah.
Do we think that has just gone away and that Trump, because it could, I mean, right, the reaction to Trumpism could force all of that into remission in the Democratic Party, in theory, or do we think that that still is lurking out there and that it will require
It's lurking
some...
in my Twitter mentions. It's the Chapo, the Chapo crowd.
The Chapo type. The AOC, essentially the AOC
That's
crowd.
Real, but the thing is, Bernie, it's underappreciated that Bernie also just attracted just regular Democrat, young liberals, right? Like, and that's a huge part of the Democratic base, right? Like Obama in 08, he united black voters with Kucinich voters, right? The farthest left anti-war.
He was Howard Dean plus African-Americans.
So, yeah, so Sanders was a little different than that, right? But his was, you know, the Kucinich voter and the Chapo voter. But, you know, then sort of these younger, you know, white college-educated Obama voters that, you know, just didn't like Hillary for a variety of reasons. So I think that base still exists, and Trump kind of did the same thing, right? Like there was this 20% of the party, but then he also attracted moderate
Country
Republican.
Club types.
So that could happen again in the Democratic Party, but you've got to connect it with another part of the base. So, Sherrod, right, like could, you know, has that sort of blue collar. I think Sherrod is honestly the only guy that has really given a good rationale for why he should be the nominee that so far out of the people on the left. He has a very on message kind of brand about, you know, the dignity of work and winning back these voters that you were lost to Trump. But like, who else can he pick up? Right.
I worry about it. When I look at this, I think the Democratic side looks like it is Bernie's to lose. To me, and maybe that's wrong, and maybe he won't even wind up running, right? I mean, he could take a long look at this
Fields
and just decide.
The other thing is everybody is a critic in everything in life, but in politics, and so just like our primary last time, this field that seems so strong and all these people that are coming in within like 5 months, there's going to be a Jonathan Martin story about how the Democrats are unhappy with all their choices, and maybe Michelle Obama should get in, right? Like there's always this.
If Michelle Obama were to declare, she'd be the nominee.
Oh, for sure. She is by far.
And actually, I think the field is quite weak. I don't think it is a strong field as we look at it prospectively, and that's why I think there's a tremendous field open for somebody we're not thinking about, a non-traditional candidate to come in.
I agree to that. In my view, if you I would have been on the show 3 months ago, I'm wrong about almost everything, so I like to brag when I'm right about something, is that had Beto, Abrams, or Gillum, like if you'd asked me in October of 18 to take the Democratic field as it existed or Beto, Abrams, and Gillum, I was taking Beto, Abrams, and Gillum because I felt I think the senators all are sort of old. I think Bernie, there's just this such hatred from the Hillary people. They feel like Bernie caused Trump. Anybody who there's a the Democrats can blame for Trump coming in has a big problem. So that's why I go against you on Bernie being Bernie's to lose. But that in theory I think was the same. Now Beto ended up kind of filling that, even though he lost. Whether he actually ends up running or just, you know, becomes like a screenplay writer traveling the country, Jack Kerouac style, I don't know. But I think he would sort of, you know, fill that, you know, what you're talking about. But I agree with you. I think that within 3 months, people are going to say Kamala Harris's record in California was too, you know, she was too strong on crime, and, you know, Beto's too emo, and, you know, Elizabeth Warren's too far left, and, you know, all these senators are boring, and, you know, there's going to be a desire for somebody else. I just don't know who would fit that bill at this point.
Oprah.
Do you remember the Oprah boom lid of like 8 months ago? That was glorious.
Didn't Crystal endorse her?
Yeah, Bill was really into Oprah.
Is Oprah tough on terrorists? Where is Oprah?
You get a Gitmo cell. Oprah's everything to all people. This is the genius of Oprah. So I don't know. Sarah, anything else?
Well, Tim, you'll have to come back, hopefully, you know, 3 months from now. Well, when do you think, we can close with this. When do you think if a Republican primary challenger we're going to get in, when do you think they need to announce?
Depends on who it is. I think that if you are somebody who is going with the Tim Miller strategy, that you want to build a platform for yourself and take a run at this and have something to say about this future of the party and conservatism, and you're not somebody that is already kind of defined. I think if you're a Kasich, a Romney, a Haley, like, you're already defined. But if you're somebody outside of that, I think sooner rather than later. If I'm Haley or, you know, some of the fantasy, candidates that you would consider, wait, right? You're waiting to just kind of see what happens with Mueller. If you're somebody like that that already has a kind of future, Haley's going to be fine in the Republican Party no matter what happens, right? So why sort of risk that, you know, until you kind of see how things happen with Mueller, see how, you know, the economy terms, see what the next crazy thing that Trump does is. And so if you remember Buchanan, you wouldn't remember because we're youthful. But if you remember from your history books, Buchanan got in. I want to ask you, when do you think Pat Buchanan got in 1987? For the 1988 primary. Oh, wait. 91 versus 92. Sorry. Campaign against Bush.
July 4th.
Christmas.
Really?
Yeah. It was like a couple weeks before the New Hampshire primary. I think the New Hampshire primary back then was in February or March, so maybe 2 months. But it was really late. Really, really late. And he was sort of bandying it about and you know, blustering. But, he didn't actually announce and say, I'm doing this until very close to the primary. And I could see an alternate vision from kind of what I laid out in my article where somebody does that. You know, something happens with Mueller, scandal and corruption, something, you know, the Democratic oversight. I mean, everybody agrees that Donald Trump was a criminal before he became president. This is, I think, underappreciated that now the Democrats are in charge. And so they're not limited in what they can investigate. They can go investigate, you know, his criminality at the Trump Organization, which is, you know, without a doubt, even Trump supporters. I tweet periodically, if you're a Trump supporter and you don't think Trump committed financial crimes before he was president, or I would like to hear from you, and you can't find anybody. You wait for something like that, and you could have a fantasy candidate get in, I think, you know, all the way up until probably, you know, Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, I mean, if his job approval is at 36 in November, sure, that's a very different proposition than whether it's 44.
Right.
Right, I mean, 44 is still not good. 44 is still on track to lose reelect. But at 36, all of a sudden, people start thinking, maybe this is emergency brake glass.
Yeah. I do want to say, though, there is that opportunity to get in now.
Yeah.
I think somebody should. And honestly, if the worst case scenario is you're somebody that gets into this race and has a lower name ID right now, and you run a smart, honorable campaign, and Donald Trump tanks, and, you know, Nikki Haley comes in and swoops it away from you, and
you've done a great service to the country and to the Republican Party.
Yeah, for sure. So I hope somebody gets in soon, but I think that regardless, there's an opportunity for a late play depending on events.
Tim, Sarah, thank you for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow with Charlie Sykes, and we'll do this all over again.